Ben Lamb has a career of building successful, fantastic deep tech businesses. And George Church has a career of commercializing amazing genetic science out of university. I thought that this would be an amazing duo because they're the co-founders of Colossal to discuss the decentralization of science, but also really focus on the traditional science and academia. I learned a lot, mostly focused around the idea that academic science does work, and it works for a lot of people, and it's gotten us up to a certain level. And I think that it takes a certain personality type to make this happen and make the value work for scientists in a specific way. I hope you really enjoy this conversation. I was very fortunate to be able to do this interview. So, enjoy.
Welcome to the Boost VC podcast. I'm really amped for today's conversation with Ben Lamb, who is the CEO and co-founder of Colossal, which Boost VC is an investor in, but I guess the only way to say it is bringing back the woolly mammoth, but I know there's more. Obviously, it's grounded in amazing research. Is that good?
We are the world's first de-extinction company, but we are working on a lot of gestational technologies that will help endangered animals as well. But
I think we are 100% talking about de-extinction. How did you say that? De-extinction.
We call it de-extinction because we're de-extincting genes to help create species that can, you know, also help the world.
And then we are also here with the professor at MIT and Harvard, which I feel is a conflict personally, but that is with George Church, and who has been in academia for a very long time. One of the reasons that I wanted to bring this team together was I've been spending a lot of time in the decentralization of science, and I wanted to have a conversation around the people who are innovating inside the system and not only just people who are trying to rebuild a new system. And so I thought that this would be a really great conversation. Well, thank you guys for doing this with me. So thank you.
Thanks for having me and George, I guess.
The first question I've been starting every single one of these episodes with is, can either of you define science for me?
I think that's the George
question. I guess I'll take a crack at that since I'm supposedly a scientist, but I lump it in with engineering a little bit. They're entangled for me. And I would say that not so much about hypothesis testing, it's about predicting and creating new options for humanity long term. So it's really about predicting the future, predicting what will happen if we do X, Y, or Z. I think that's what science is up to. And we do a lot of discovery in order to enable that.
And is there a specific process or pursuit? I'm assuming it's grounded in scientific methodology would be my, it's engineering and science discover the future? So it's like, you're just thinking I'm creating the future or discovering knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, you want to predict what will happen when you create the future. You don't want to just create a dystopia if you possibly avoid it. I think there's a lot of methods. It's not one scientific method. There's a lot of methods, and there's a lot of ways to succeed and to fail. And there's all kinds of personalities, and it's diverse. I think that.
So you're taking it one. Sorry,
try to aim for a consensus truth, even though very often the breakthroughs come from the anti-consensus, the outliers.
This definition is fascinating me because your answer is sort of taking every other answer one step further, which is, hey, if something happens, we want to make sure that we're building a better world. Is that sort of what you're saying? You're saying hey, not just dystopian. We want it to make sure that it's this better world.
Better by at least some definitions, yes.
And so is there, grounded in that, it sounds like there's an ethical conversation around science.
There are some scientists that I think avoid the ethical issues, because it either seems fluffy or dangerous to tread in there. And then there's others like me who feel like it's an obligation to talk about what could go wrong and what and how to avoid that up front, ideally years and years before you actually have to make the decision. Because if you're making decisions on the fly while it's happening, you're going to be very reactive and you're going to probably even collectively will make bad decisions.
Yeah. And so for a case study, sorry to interrupt, for a case study, let's Colossal, you and Ben like have formed this company that's de-extincting things. As a case study saying like, hey, if we de-extinct the woolly mammoth, like, have you thought about what that means? Like for like, and what does that mean? I was just thinking, this is awesome, if possible, historic. However, now I'm thinking like, is it gonna, like maybe there's, is there any issue?
Well, I think there's issues with every new technology, and it's not a good idea to reassure people, but to have a broad conversation where you're getting everybody's concerns out on the table. I think we've addressed a lot of them publicly, yeah, transparently, but I still, it's not my role to reassure. For example, there was concerns that they would be lonely. There would be one elephant that was cold resistant and it would be lonely. That's clearly not our intention. Or that their environment has disappeared years ago. And I can tell you from having been in Siberia that it is actually quite cold there. It's minus 40 in the winter. So global warming has not quite wiped out the minus 40 winters. And there's a concern that it will change the ecosystem. Well, that is actually the point, is that we want to restore the ecosystem to a different ratio of grass to trees in order to preserve the 1,400 gigatons of carbon that is at risk and to sequester additional carbon at a rate that really is only possible in the Arctic.
So, Adam, I think to your question, there's definitely ethical issues to think through, but this wasn't something that we just randomly thought of on a Thursday. George has been working with Sergey Nikita Zimov for a decade. George has been working on this project and researching it for many, many years. So I think that there's definitely ethical issues to think through, but we're trying to be we believe in radical transparency. So we're trying to take all of that research, bring it to life, answer the questions. But one of the things that George and I often laugh about is that we love skeptics and we love people that give us the negative feedback, because you learn a lot of more from people that are like questioning things than when people just say, this is going to be awesome, right? Like, we love the people that are going to say this is going to be awesome, but we also love it when people, give us feedback, because a lot of times we can learn from that. And we're not going to do everything perfect. We're going to do the best we can. To George's point, it's not our job to reassure people. Our job is to do things as best we can and as ethically and as transparent as possible. But, we do learn a lot from the folks that give us that feedback. So a lot of the feedback that George mentioned that we got at launch, we had answers for, and the ones that we didn't, it helped inform our strategy, which is great.
Yeah, I like the haters fuel you mentality. I think that's a good general mentality to have.
We don't want them to be haters, but we want them to. We don't want them to be haters, but we do want them to give us their concerns, because there will be things that we overlook, and so it's really helpful when we do get that feedback.
Well, I always think about it with Bitcoin. Bitcoin was this hot take where everyone I ever talked to was like, it can't happen, right? Like, this will not work. What it did was it made me actually spend more time thinking about why it would work and trying to disprove it, like why, and continue. And once you have this like truth in you, you have to like let it out. And so to me, that's what it sounds like. It sounds like you sort of have this like truth, and then you have a lot of people who are sort of like, no, it shouldn't happen. Or the worst for me anyway was dismissive. So like, I like people who rooted with me. I like people who like were really angry, who like fought me. The people in the middle were frustrating. Like the people who were like, is that Bitcoin thing still a thing? And then they started talking about something else.
That's probably why you love Colossal, because I feel like there's not a lot of middle. I think there's a lot of people There's a lot of people that are very proactively supportive, which is amazing. And then there's people, there are people that aren't as supportive. And, you know, I think that luckily for us, there's way more supportive than not supportive. But as I mentioned, we learn a lot from the people that aren't supportive. But that's why I think you're probably attracted to Colossal in the first place, is because I don't think there's a lot of people that are like, you know, de-extinction. Eh.
Yeah. There's some things that are like absolute certainties. And when you bring them an alternative, they go, nope, still an absolute certainty that it is not true. Right. Like when things go extinct, they go extinct. They don't get brought back from, there's no zombie species, right? that's what you're creating, zombie species. Well, okay. So all of this was grounded in, well, obviously research over many, many years. But if George, you could take me back just a little bit. You've spent a long career in academia. You're still teaching. You're still researching. You're still leading teams. Everyone respects you in the industry. Like, why academia? Why was that the best way for you to spend your time?
Well, you know, actually, most of my career, I've been at the interface between academia and industry, all going back to my student days, where I was one of the first employees at Biogen and also a consultant, Bio-Rad. But in any case, the academia part, you know, why I keep mostly invested there is, you know, I like working with very young people who haven't yet made up their mind what they're going to do and are open to all kinds of ideas that other people would be dismissive of, where the crowd would be dismissive, but the individual students. I also was, even before that, I think I had this vast curiosity. You've probably heard of Curious George. Well, that's, I identify with that character. And it's just the possibility of having a diversity of ideas is what happens in a university. It's not about one thing. It's almost the opposite. A university is attempting to be universal in its pursuit of knowledge.
Sometimes I have a hard time with podcasts with George, because while George is a genius, I think he's really funny. And so... I just couldn't get over the Curious George comment. And so we were on a podcast with 100,000 people and are on a video cast, and George made some comment that I don't think anyone got. And I was crying. I like laughed for like 15. I couldn't pull it together. So for as smart as George is, I think he missed his calling as a comedian, because I don't know if everyone gets all of his jokes. But I just, sometimes podcasts are hard with me when I'm with George on them, because I sometimes just can't help myself.
I'm still thinking about the Curious George thing, and I'm just like, what? Like, but I have young kids, and like, we watch that, and Curious George gets into all sorts of trouble.
I also identify with the kind of the primate mentality just in general.
Shortest distance between thought and action. Is that
there you go.
I might know something about it. In academia, the reason that I'm sort of asking this is, you know, there are a lot of people who have felt stifled by classic academia. There's a lot of complaints about publishing and citing being sort of this metric of success in the space. And there's a group of people who are trying to finance themselves through decentralized ways, right? Like new experiments that are happening outside of academia that generally show progress. And so I was just wondering, in your career, if you've ever felt stifled. I mean, it sounds like you've always been at the edge of it, Biogen, and like you've been at the edge of academia, not specifically inside of academia. Has it ever stifled you? Is there more friction, or is it not that frictionful? And you're just sort of like, I don't even know what these people
are talking
about.
Maybe I didn't have sufficient self-preservation instincts. And so I just did whatever I wanted. And some of it would, I think, embrace some of the experiments that I did early on would embrace what you might call decentralized. I mean, we did things like citizen science, Personal Genome Project was one of the things I started. How to Grow Almost Anything is international, like web course. iGEM is like for high school and undergraduate students all over the world. DIY Bio, all these things. So it wasn't really just academia and industry. It was academia, industry, and all these other weirdnesses that were much more aimed at citizens. And I think that kind of makes you feel like there aren't really any limitations. But I can see how other people, I mean, we have to respect people who didn't have my pathway or didn't have my inability to see what was in front of me.
Your focus.
My lack of focus.
Or lack thereof. But also, I like the lack of self-preservation.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. It still feels that academia attracts incredible talented people for, and obviously you continue to teach at MIT and Stanford. I mean, Harvard, not Stanford, maybe Stanford also. It sounds like, you know, equal opportunities.
Just occasional lecture, not a full-time gig. No.
And you find these brilliant younger people who have not been conditioned yet, and they welcome the wild and outrageous and audacious idea. And it sounds like that's sort of special in academia. I like that. I like
It's also about concentration or central. It's not so much centralization, it's concentration of minds. So they can have, you know, brainstorming sessions late at night and they can just kind of hang out. In principle, you can do that the way we're doing it now, you know, over the internet.
I thought you meant a couple beers. No.
That's
true.
Yeah. So it's just that we have all this legacy social networking that's based on touching, having beers, you know, being in each other's face, literally, that kind of got a new start with Web3 and with COVID-19.
Yeah, the fast forward of like being able to decentralize like the actual thoughts also, like get everyone's independently everywhere. One of the things that I think you both are relatively familiar with is the getting, I mean, you've had to probably raise money for certain things inside the academia institution and outside. It sounds like, Ben, to you, Colossal and Hypergiant are targeting contracts. Like government-based contracts or like funding, how do you see that progressing? And like, is the government relationship with academia, with your company, like important? Like, I've spent a fair amount of time in the space. You had Hypergiant and Colossal, and both of them, it feels like, are a part of this.
Yeah, I think that when you're doing
funding world,
yeah, when you're doing, you know, very little of our funding comes at Colossal currently from the federal government. But, you know, when you're doing big, bold things, you know, I think it's good to not just have relationships with top universities like, you know, Harvard, MIT and others. But I think it's also critical that, you know, when you're building technologies that have potential national security applications, you know, and you're really a kind of bleeding edge science.
Just in case you start a army of mammoths.
Battle mammoths. The only battle mammoths they'll be fighting is bad carnivorous trees in the Arctic. But for us, you know, synthetic biology as a whole is a pretty interesting topic for the world, right? And to some of the ethics questions and discovery questions that you asked early on. And so I think it's really important to always engage, you know, not just the university minds, but also engage, you know, the federal minds, right? And so my last company, you mentioned Hypergiant, more focused on Department of Defense type work because it mostly works with, you know, Space Force and Air Force and Army. But, you know, Colossal, you know, Arctic rewilding, and we've got to work with not just the U.S. government, but we've got to work with all of the governments, you know, in the Arctic if we're going to be successful at long-term rewilding and putting these species back, you know, into their natural habitat. And we also have to work with the indigenous people groups, right? And so, you know, I think that especially with a project like Colossal, you've got to even lean in more. So even if it's not about government contracts, I think you've got to have government collaboration and support around this. But I do think that, you know, the federal government and many governments know the effects of climate change and also loss of biodiversity. So we are getting a lot of really great support from the folks that we're talking to at the various levels, at the various countries. So we are getting really good feedback as people realize that these are pretty major topics that, you know, outside of climate change, but loss of biodiversity and species preservation are pretty, you know, hot button topics for people.
Yeah, you brought up climate change. Was that one of the original reasons for this? Well, I guess I'm like, you know, the leap from mammoths to climate change. There's a little bit of a leap from like the seat I'm in. What is that? How do you bridge that gap? Like, what? Why? I mean, I get mammoths would probably sequester more carbon or create a better forestation.
The grass. The grass really sequesters carbon better than most plants do, and the grass got displaced by trees when the herbivores disappeared, probably thanks to some of our ancestors. So the elephants are the only herbivore that's capable of knocking down trees, and they love knocking down trees. And so they leave plenty of trees, but they restore the grassland. So that and it sequesters carbon particularly well in the Arctic, because each season you bury or you freeze all the roots and all the shoots from the grasses, and then you build another layer on top of that. And so the thickness of the carbon soil layer is sometimes 500 meters in the Arctic. Well, it can be as little as a meter in the other forests of the world where the carbon turns over rather than accumulating.
Do you think the mammoth needs to be in the Arctic, or is that one of the places that we're going to have these mammoths? And Arctic is fascinating, by the way, as a whole geopolitical thing. And I actually looked into this because the reason that Trump wanted to buy Greenland at the beginning of his term in office was because 25% of all the natural resources are beneath the surface of the Arctic. And so Russia, US, all these people are trying to get closer to the Arctic to be able to own the stuff. That's a whole different thing. But on the topic, are you just going to let them loose in the Arctic, or where are the mammoths? I mean, we don't have a mammoth yet, so I guess we're doing predictive things.
Right, we're being pretty thoughtful. And we, George, before, I got it in the picture, had been collaborating deeply with the folks at Pleistocene Park, which he can talk about, here in a second. But there are certain concentrations of carbon and methane in the Arctic that, have been identified. So we can actually be really thoughtful about where we put hubs. They're also in places with low population density, which is not just good for, the elephants, but it's also really good for people. And so we're starting those conversations with the indigenous people groups of those regions, as well as the local governments of those regions, to ensure that we have a plan. Because even though we don't have mammoths yet, knowing that we're on this journey and our goal is Arctic rewilding, not just, Arctic elephant creation. It's actually in the rewilding process is what we define success as. It's really important that we start those conversations now, because to your point, it's a complicated geopolitical landscape right now. It's gotten even more complicated since we started the company in certain regions Russia and whatnot. But, I think that starting those conversations now are really, really critical for us to, one, not just get approvals, but bring them into the process really early on.
Can I ask an off-the-wall question?
You can ask anything.
Well, I guess it's you guys are waiting on my questions, I guess.
Yeah, it's your podcast.
I mean, why are we going with woolly mammoths? Why not going with things that haven't existed, like a whale mammoth, like a water-oriented whale?
I think that I'll let
situation.
I'll let George, obviously comment on this, but I think that, we really need to put the why behind this, right? It makes a lot of sense for us to focus on mammoths because they did exist. They have a close, phylogenetic relative. Okay. The technologies that we're developing can help endangered species. We can actually be really thoughtful around elephant conservation and apply some of these technologies to elephant conservation. So I think there's a lot of, outside of just the Arctic rewilding aspects of it, there's a lot of conservation benefits and elephants need our help, right? There's a virus called EEHV, which kills up to 25% of elephants at the time of weaning. We are actively working on that. We're also funding other research on that, right? So I don't know if an elephant, whale, mammoth thing is probably the right area to focus. I think maybe in the future, there's all kinds of stuff that people can do that are interesting with synthetic biology. But I think there's a lot of reason to go focus on this outside of the Arctic rewilding side, which is also helping endangered species. And a lot of times the mammoth gets the headlines, but a lot of the work we're doing can be really helpful to endangered species. And a lot of times that is back burner because, people don't necessarily think it's as cool, but, we think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, George, do you have a comment on my whale?
Yeah, sure. So, I think the technology we're developing could help endangered whale species, but as whales, not as whale-elephant hybrids. We are not restricted to you make a good point, is we're not restricted to the ancient ones or the new elephants species. We can also create slightly new, not quite as new as a whale hybrid, but slightly new things like virus resistance, maybe even resistance to all viruses. We controlling tusk length so that you can have them very short where they might be at risk from poachers, very long where they might have advantages for whatever the business model is.
And how did you two, you know, you obviously both are partners in this colossal endeavor, no pun intended. And the, it's a good name, colossal. It's such a good name. What, how did you two get to know each other? Like what led to this formation of a company? What was the, how did you two know each other and build enough trust? Like what was that?
The reality is it was a cold call. I cold called George, and for better or worse, he answered. And we got a call scheduled, and I originally called him just to talk about cool stuff in his lab because my background's mostly in software, and was thinking that I could build some type of AI, synthetic biology, CRISPR-esque thing. I think, you know, 4 minutes in, moved to Mammoth and Arctic Rewilding, and I literally didn't even sleep that night. And then I think after our first meeting in the lab at George's lab in, at Harvard, I don't know, I feel like we saw eye to eye in that first meeting. He said some really funny, weird stuff. I didn't run away. Like that, so maybe that was out of
that. That curious George is his spirit animal.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, George. I mean, I don't know. I remember leaving that meeting being like, that guy is not who I thought he was. He's great.
Before subpar, after great. The management of expectations is the superpower that we all need.
Yeah, it was right. It was great.
And I'm so many quite like. What drove, okay, this is for George specifically, like why did you decide to commercialize anything? Because I find that a lot of these a lot of company, a lot of professors, a lot of researchers, a lot of, like, they hold it very tight to the chest. They hold everything a little tight, really tight to the chest. I've gotten tours and they're like, hey, don't take any pictures. Like I've got, you know, you see all this stuff and then they don't think about commercialization. Why are you thinking about commercialization? Like, why are you thinking about starting a company to, and I know it's not about the woolly mammoth, but that's the easiest way to sort of comprehend what it is. But like, why was this and others, I know that there've been others, like why have you thought about commercialization in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I've been involved in starting, co-founding 40 companies.
Quickly, can you just list them all off? Like, just for...
No. I can tell you some of the recent ones. I mean,
I'm kidding. I was joking.
Anyway, we don't really have that. I try not to have that many secrets. I'm good at keeping other people's secrets, but I see no particular point. And I tell my people, don't worry about other people stealing your ideas. Worry about your ideas not getting taken up by society at all. And then I think that is what they concern themselves with. I think science, you know, when I was growing up, scientists sort of felt like, well, if I publish it, then we're done. And if you're a technology developer and you just publish a paper, that is not going to go anywhere. That's not going to, if you wanted to help society, you have to take it another step beyond publication. You have to, somebody has to accompany it into the, toward the marketplace. You have to find the funding to get it scaled up and debugged, you know, and so forth. So I learned that pretty early on. And since we are a technology development lab, which isn't a typical biology lab, we just do it more than other people. And it becomes one of these things, whatever you do, you by hard knocks, you get a little bit better at it. So we just, it's a positive feedback loop.
So you've done this 40 times where you felt that the research was at a level enough that it could commercialize. What leads to that decision? Like what's like, hey, I got an inkling here. This is good. That was bad. This is good. Like what's that?
Well, it's not so much bad and good. It's premature. And you know, if you make a mistake, it's not that bad. In fact, we try to make lots of mistakes and on our way to making the right thing. Failure is an option in contrast to the NASA motto. But the thing is, if you go a little bit early, then basically you'll get instant feedback to the investors. They're not going to throw money at something that's really bad.
And we're
not going to tell them things that it would deceive them. You know, we want to be transparent and make sure that. So that's one feedback that we get early on. Sometimes there's feedback from the other side where so many people are asking us for this stuff in academia or while we're in academia that it becomes distracting. You know, we can't just like keep cranking out, you know, for example, we made sequencing devices early on and we couldn't just keep cranking those out academically. It would be very distracting and you don't really get papers for the second and third device that you build. And so we actually put the first of the next gen sequencing devices, the plans for it on the internet. We made it completely open source. I think it still may be the only open source DNA sequencing device, one of the few open source devices. But we also commercialize it, knowing that even open sourcing it with full details was not enough. And it ended up being present in intact in three companies and in parts in two others. And that's the sort of thing that we do.
You know, it's counterintuitive the way that both of you are building this company in a lot of ways. You know, like there are a lot of ways people think like, hey, founder comes up with the idea, founder is CEO, founder, you know, like there's this process that a lot of people believe is the way, which, you know, always there's exceptions to all the rules. Like, why is this a method that can work? Like, why? Because there's obviously you're in academia, you're in commercialization, you're both, I mean, after meeting you, you guys are both awesome. And this is like obvious, but like what puts together the right chemistry to make chemistry, pun intended, to make like the basic infrastructure for a good company in science, where science is driving that thing. Does that make sense? Do you understand the question?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'll mainly let Ben handle it, but some of my companies that have had less than spectacular outcomes has been because they're either the CEO was not right for that particular task. I mean, they might be wonderful people, even good CEOs, but you know, like one of my CEOs had never had less than 600 employees, and he was just not ready for a little startup that was going to take a while to get going. And also, it helps if you have some curiosity about science. You don't have to have a MD, PhD, but you know, Ben has just the right attitude towards curiosity, and he remembers everything. I can say it once, and then he'll be saying it in the next interview with perfect pitch. So, sure. And he inspires people, I think.
That's high praise.
I know good CEOs when I see them at this point after working with 40 of them.
No, well, that's really nice of you. Yeah, George and I work great together. But one of the things is like being a lifelong technology entrepreneur that's always had to like come up with the idea, find the product market fit, build a team, raise money, evangelize it, and kind of go through that circle, right? All the way through outcome, manage boards, and you know, just everything you got to do in building a company. If you could take any of those pieces off your plate, it's pretty great, right? And so there are so many great ideas and so many brilliant minds in academia, let alone just in the church lab. And so it's like, you know, when we did our deal with George and in Harvard, we also recruited some folks from George's lab. So a lot of our core science team came out of the George's lab, right? And still collaborate with George's lab. We still have collaborators in George's lab. And so it's really interesting, you know, Harvard George's lab and Colossal collaborating together. But, you know, there's so many great ideas out there that if you just say, okay, like, I don't know if I will ever, you know, go back to being like the drawing board of like, let me go think of an idea and spend lots of time, you know, looking at ideas. When there's so many incredible, you know, women and men in academia that have spent, you know, a decade or more on a thing. And then, so if you just like spend time understanding that and then figuring out what product market fit is and how to support it financially with the right team and the right structure. For me as an entrepreneur, it makes, you know, there's one less thing you have to do is like come up with the idea, right?
The way both of you talk, it feels like you're, both pirates, it would be how I, and right now looking at both of you, you're pirates. the it's the beards. I wish I could grow one as great, and that's why I just keep the high and tight upstairs. It feels like you've embraced a different methodology. You know, I've been interviewing all these people who are across Decentralizing is Science who they're a little frustrated with publishing and citations. And obviously, George, you've built up an amazing brand as just an academic professor who's obviously been credited with tons of citations across all of your works. It almost doesn't feel like you're in classic academia. That's what it, and so I wanted to understand, like, or you are in classic, just the way you're talking about it, you're free. It feels like, you know, you're free to do whatever you want. And it feels amazing because it feels like the best science is going to be created out of it, whatever it is. And I'm fascinated with the structures that end up sort of forming to work and align incentives, and whatever those alignment of incentives generally drive progress. And it feels like you've figured out something that a lot of people just haven't. You've started 40 different companies, and obviously, Ben, you've started multiple different companies, and you're seeing this alignment of incentives just work. What the hell?
Well, I think maybe you're hiring.
Do you think anyone can do this? Is it anyone in academia could be doing this? Are you the only special one, or is it like this could be anyone across all of academia should be doing this to commercialize great products?
Yeah, I'll change my name to Neo. How's that?
Perfect.
Anyway, you know, I'm hoping that some of my students will be able to do this. It does. There is a bit of a getting the positive feedback loop going. It helps that we already had a positive feedback loop going sort of in the Boston area on biomedical research. And there's very high concentration of, you know, pharma companies and so forth. That helps. But anyway, after you get a few successes, then everybody has kind of the opposite problem, which is they think they can't lose or won't lose. I think what stops a lot of people is kind of fear of failure. If you're worried about failing, you've already got one failure going on. Because if you don't try, you're definitely going to fail. And I think that's the key thing, is you can't be too worried about failing. You know, you have to trust in the American system to some extent that you, even if you completely fail, go bankrupt, you can come back out of the ashes. Now, I haven't gone bankrupt yet, but I was willing to.
I guess for both of you, my question is, like, what was the single biggest risk that you took earlier on? Because obviously you're both on a snowballing effect of something right now. Like, it sounds like, George, in your academia, you launched a couple companies, which was a little crazy at some point in time. And then, Ben, you've obviously started a fair number of companies and had pretty great success. Like, where was the leap of faith that gave you the feedback loop? I want to know that. That's what I want to know. That's what I think this is about.
What?
The feedback loop.
I feel like I had an unfair advantage because I had a great family support system where my grandmother told me every day that if I worked hard enough, I could do anything. So I had this, like, I don't know if it was a real feedback loop, but it was, or a falsified feedback loop, but it definitely made me feel like I didn't need a net because my Gigi told me every day that I could do anything. Gigi's just like, you can do anything. And I'm like, I kind of believed it. And I was like, oh, I can do anything. And maybe that's what led to Colossal. But so I think I had this grandmother, or I still have this grandmother. She's great. And, you know, that literally just kind of created a feedback loop in my brain that said, you just go do it, right? And if it doesn't work, just keep doing it. It's not your fault it doesn't work. So she just kind of reinforced that in me. And then, you know, I'd say probably my biggest leap was after I started my first company and sold it, and I stayed on for a little while, I wanted to go do something else. And I was like, can I do this again? Like, is it possible to do a second? Like, that to me was a big moment where I was like, because I was in my 20s and I was like, can I start another company?
Gigi's voice was in your head and it was just like, Gigi, yeah, like, you can do anything.
Yeah, you can do anything. And so I just kind of did it. And then after the second one, I was like, oh yeah, this is, you know, there's more than one data point here. So I feel good about the potential third one.
That's a good answer. George, where was your leap of faith?
Well, I think I had advantages and disadvantages. One of my disadvantages growing up is I didn't know any scientists or engineers at all. They didn't even teach science until eighth grade. But then when I did finally meet some scientists like Wally Gilbert, he was fearless himself. And he had switched from theoretical particle physics to molecular biology around the time he would be up for tenure. But, you know, I think the other
thing. What a rebel.
A lot of my colleagues were, you know, they had never failed. They had had a basically monotonically improving career all the way through high school and college. And they just were not willing to take risks as a consequence. Well, mine was far from monotonically increasing. I had to repeat ninth grade. I was dyslexic, could barely read. I had to repeat a couple of years of graduate school because I completely flunked out of graduate school. But having failed those things, you know, that's like the equivalent of bankruptcy in academia, is flunking out of graduate school. And it just made me say, that wasn't so bad, you know? And
having the worst thing happen.
Yeah, you know, it's not so bad. And then I was fearless enough or stupid enough to only apply to one graduate school after flunking out of Duke, which was I applied to Harvard. And, you know, you would think that having flunked out, you would have at least a safety net of some sort. But again, I had not yet wised up. But I got in. So, you know, and then so that reinforces this. That was my sort of my equivalent of Gigi was, you know, I had this feeling that I could survive.
No matter what. And you were curious. It was the curiosity.
Very curious. And I sought out other curious people.
But, see, you are pirates. You weren't in that. Absolutely. You're not in the system. Okay, in 50 years, looking back for both of you individually, I would love for, and then what we can do is get into, I have a lightning round thing that I'm going to do with you both, but looking back in 50 years, you look back on today, what do you think the biggest impact is going to be of a colossal or research that you've done? Like what is that thing? What's the impact created in 50 years?
I don't want to. George may have a different perspective on colossal, but I think I think it's hard to pick, but I think the two biggest things that will come out of colossal is ex utero development. So artificial womb development for multitude of species that I think could change species preservation and have applications far reaching into humans, as well as, you know, 50 years from now, I hope that there's, you know, thousands of interbreedable Arctic elephants, you know, in the permafrost in an entire Pleistocene-like environment that, you know, we seeded and then grew from that, you know, that inspires the world while, you know, sequestering carbon. So I think, you know, I do think some of the technologies like ex utero development and artificial wombs are just as transformative potentially as, you know, some of the Arctic rewilding aspects and de-extinction aspects of our work. But those would be the two that I would like to see.
Yeah, and I guess my take on it is to look forward 50, I'm going to look back 50. And it's been almost exactly 50 years when I decided I would start studying transfer RNA, which is an obscure molecule for some people, but I've been working on my whole life, basically. And that led me to test ideas about transfer RNA, which is the genetic code which connects DNA, RNA, and proteins, then you need to be able to change all of that genome-wide, which resulted in interest in reading and writing genomes, which then led almost directly to the kind of engineering that we're doing with Ben. So I think that is going to be something that will have impact. It's been 50 years in the making, but now it's going so fast, it's like a free fall in a good way.
It's like accelerating and like a super, like a G or two G's, like where you're, have you been in a Tesla with the plaid mode or whatever?
I've not been in plaid mode. Richard Garriott got one and he was trying to get me and he's like, you've got to come ride in it. He's like,
it's genuinely the scariest thing on the planet Earth. It is just terrifying. It feels like, it feels like you're skydiving, but you're going this way. And it's just outrageous. It's awful.
I have been at zero gravity, which is probably similar.
So it feels like that, but someone else is in control of a car, and you see the cars coming at you, and it's just
unreal.
I was just not ready. It was one of those moments where he goes, "You ready?" And I said, "Sure." And then it just took off, and I was like, "I am not ready. I am not ready." You know, like, I'll do the lightning round. The lightning round. I think we can lead in the lightning round. Because I think we've covered a lot. Actually, yeah, we've covered it. We're good. Lightning round! Okay. Both of you have to answer this question. All the questions, okay? What's your favorite animal?
George.
Elephant.
Mammoth.
Okay, why? On both of them. Why?
Because
It's a vegan like me. It is big like a dinosaur, which all kids love dinosaurs, you know, mostly. And it is very charismatic to the public. And it has the potential. The word keystone species really describes it very well.
Yeah. So basically my answer is all of those. Plus it's got like a really great coat and outfit. So the mammoth is just an elephant with a cooler outfit.
Okay. What's the greatest invention of your lifetime?
I think the iPhone.
Yeah. If you mean my invention.
Take it however you want.
Yeah. I would say multiplex reading and writing of genomes.
Which, you know, I know what that is, but Ben's having trouble knowing what that is.
He knows what that is. Your audience would like me to unpack it.
My audience would like you. I know Ben knows what it is. I was kidding. What is multiplex genome?
It's basically being able to read your genome and all the genomes in the world. We're on a trajectory for doing that. Certainly, you know, we brought down the cost of reading a genome from $3 billion to $300, and it's still dropping. And so it's at a point where it could really impact medicine. It is impacting medicine in a big way. And then being able to write genomes is taking that information that we get from all these genomes and using it to engineer elephants, as we've been describing, pigs to do heart and various organ transplants, improving crops, and so on. So that's reading and writing of genomes, which is what we do.
Okay, I buy that. If you were an ice cream flavor, which would you be?
Chocolate chip cookie dough.
George, I now know you're a vegan, so
yes,
maybe this is a sorbet question.
No, it's a sugar free, fat free, but still tasty sorbet. Yeah.
Okay, ready? New crazy question. Do you think it's more likely that T-Rex was an aquatic species fully, or that all dinosaurs were the size of a dog?
I think T-Rex had feathers.
Yeah,
but okay. It didn't fly. Apparently it didn't wasn't like a duck.
Apparently hollow bones, but I wouldn't say primarily an aquatic species. But I think that, yeah, that's like you just gave us two bad choices. It's like, I think
it might have been aquatic the same way humans are aquatic. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Or
panthers, you know, if you have to.
Yeah, if you have to. But I don't think, I don't know if that the latest Apple special on dinosaurs was 100% accurate. But, you know, after talking to many paleontologist friends of mine, I think that they may have some issues with some of the things in that show. But, you know, I do think that we have lots of scientific proof that all dinosaurs were not the size of dogs.
Well, but I'll take just as be contrarian. I'll take that side though. I'll take both sides. That they could be the size of dogs if we include future dogs, right? Because we can engineer dogs to be the size of, you know.
Do you think we can create a dreadnoughtus dog?
Absolutely, dreadnoughtus. Canis dreadnoughtus. Yeah, you heard it here first. Yeah. I think that, you know, the dogs already vary by almost a factor of 1,000 between the very smallest and the very largest, not counting embryos and stuff, which is cheating. But yeah, I think we've already engineered them over a vast range, probably more than any other species within a species. They can all interbreed too.
A Dreadnoughtus Doberman sounds like the scariest thing I've ever heard of. Like a 60-ton Doberman.
Okay. Do you want to go to space?
Yeah, why not?
I definitely want us to be able to go into space, meaning that, humans, if we stay on Earth, we're sitting ducks for some kind of disaster. So we need to get that ability. But it may require some serious genetics to get us so that we're happy in space, you know, for many decades. It's one thing to go out there for a year and come back with all of our bones and our tissues different. But it's another thing to stay up there at zero gravity and high radiation.
Well, I just learned something about being in space. And that sounds, I didn't realize that everything changes. It does make me feel like humans are adaptable, though. But maybe that's not what.
Well, for a year, yeah.
Adaptable, but when you get back, you're just fully.
But for 80 years, we don't know. And
yeah, so we're going to have to keep challenging our bodies to go into the vacuum.
Well, we might even have to engineer them a bit. We're certainly.
This is like falling into the Chris Mason talk of
engineering. Chris and I agree on this topic. Yeah.
Well, I mean, cyborg / genetically altered humans make sense probably at some point. So that's exciting.
Hybrids are good. We have cell phones. That's cars and jets and stuff. We're already hybrids.
We're already part hybrid.
It's still not quite enough because the meat part of us has to be happy and not irradiated and having all of our fluids going in the wrong places.
Quote of the podcast, the meat part of us has to be happy. George Church.
Definitely the only quote anyone's going to remember. What about, do you think that at some point we're going to be able to upload brains into machines? Or is it always going to be we're going to have a meat part of our bodies?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be hybrid. It already is. I think that there's some pretty amazing things that we do with biology that are not yet, and not maybe even by the time that machines get that good at making things that are, for example, in biology, almost everything is atomically precise, meaning that a fraction of a nanometer actually matters. And we do it over and over reproducibly, you know, for free, basically, when the sun's shining. So atomically precise, Einstein 1905 was pretty good computer relative to any computer I've seen. Even the ones that win Jeopardy and Go have not done anything as cool as Einstein did in 1905, and Madame Curie and a bunch of other people. So I think that we are, and also the biological revolution is going faster than Moore's Law right now. So I wouldn't rule it out.
It's going faster than Moore's Law. So we're actually reducing the cost.
Right. So that we've improved, say, let's say reading and writing DNA, both of them, by about 20 million fold, most of it over the course of a decade. So it's gone 2 to 10 fold per year, while Moore's Law has gone 1.5 to 2 fold per year. So it's going faster. And energy consumption is lower. So this brain uses 20 watts. Maybe the whole body is 100 watts. And it can keep up with a variety of tasks with a 100,000 watt computer. So that's another thing to keep in mind. It's too early to say we're not going to be hybrid. And finally, uploading a brain is harder than, it's like I have a choice between photocopying the I Ching and learning Chinese and learning all the nuances of the I Ching and translating it. So changing it from a brain to a computer is much harder than just making another brain, which is also hard.
So my this will be the last question, and I thank you guys for this amazing podcast. What is your definition of success?
In general or in colossal?
General.
George?
Well, I would say it's benefiting society. Survival of the species is kind of the minimum thing that you can do. But that turns out that that's pretty hard where we are right now. So anything you can do to help that, help the next generation get going, have good conversations like this one. These are having students and offspring is a positive thing so far, it seems.
I think it's about being additive versus, you know, subtracting stuff, right? So it's like, well, maybe subtracting some things like, you know, pollution and carbon, but I think it's about creating. I think we're all kind of inspired to create, whether it's like art or music or cells or science or whatever it is, right? So I don't know. I think that it's about creating things that are additive. So I think that's success. Sometimes at a great cost, though. Like, so, you know, some people would argue that, you know, some of the people that achieve the greatest, you know, art, you know, also, or music have like the, you know, I think a lot of people sometimes think that their lives weren't successful because of their personal lives, right? But were they additive to society as a whole? So, you know, I think success is a very hard thing to quantify. But I do think that, you know, if you objectively look at making it additive to society, you know, people that have the worst, craziest, weirdest, tragic life, but created maybe the greatest music that inspired a halo effect of other things they don't even know that are measurable, would that be success? I think so. But, you know, I think others may argue that that person was not successful. If, you know, but
I think we're looking for a win-win where people can be happy and make the rest of the world happy and successful as well.
Yeah.
Floating all the boats, basically, is what we're, you know, but I agree with Ben. If you have to choose, adding something positive is a good thing.
Well, thank you guys so much for being part of the Boost VC podcast.